Welcome to the Autism Roundtable. I'm Leah Gross, founder of Circle Care Services. I'll bring you autism experts from all kinds of fields for helpful parenting ideas, insights, and strategies. Tune in for learning and support and connection. Okay, welcome Lauren Davis to the Autism Roundtable. We really appreciate you coming out and being a part of our podcast today. You come with many different hats in the autism community. Can you please introduce yourself? Tell us a little bit about your personal background and your professional background.
Sure thing. So my name is Lauren Davis. I'm an osteopathic physician, and I'm board certified in family medicine and osteopathic neuromusculoskeletal medicine. But I practice integrative and functional medicine, and I'm certified through the IFM as well. For me personally, I am also an ADHD individual. So I am very late diagnosed. I did not find out until we were having my son evaluated, who's now 7. Which is, I think, a very common thing for millennial women. And for me, I've brought both my personal passions around functional medicine and alternative forms of care into our household and how we approach autism in our family.
Wow. So
we are a full family. My husband is also ADHD. My oldest son and my 18-month-old doesn't sit still, so I'm sure he's going to be part of the neurodiverse family with us.
Oh, wow. I love how you embrace it, though, and you say it in such a positive light.
Yes.
And I do feel like, in general, the way we perceive things and the way we like, you know, put it in our minds really impacts the way that we react to different things.
Yes, absolutely. So one of the things that my husband is also a DO, he has studied hypnosis and neurolinguistic programming extensively. And one of the things that I've learned from him that comes out of that is how we frame things in our mind. The more positive we can be, it's absolutely going to affect every aspect of our life.
Wow. Wow. Very inspirational. Love it. So tell us a little bit about what you actually are trained to do. Tell us a little bit about that. And then tell us a little bit about your integrative medicine and how that impacts the autism community.
Yeah, so I am trained as a physician in the U.S. So full spectrum care as a family medicine physician. But I also did a second board certification in osteopathic neuromuscular medicine. So what that is that's basically the specialty for osteopathy in the U.S. So how to do hands-on care with different techniques, including something called craniosacral work. So I've studied cranial osteopathy, which is the precursor, right? The original, basically OG version of craniosacral, so that I can actually diagnose different dysfunctions in the head, bring that into the work that I do. And it is absolutely wonderful for the community.
Wow. I'm an occupational therapist by trade. And one of my trainings was in craniosacral. And we did a lot of like sending like the positive neurons and the negative neurons. And tell us a little bit about what craniosacral is and like how that might help somebody on the spectrum.
Yeah, so craniosacral and cranial osteopathy have developed kind of into two different things. So cranial osteopathy was the original. One of our DO founders, Dr. William Gardner Sutherland, basically looked at a skull one day and saw that the temporal bone, the bone around our ear, was beveled like he thought like the gills of a fish. So it was angled, so it looked like it should open and have motion. Well, up until that point, everyone always thought that the skull fuses into one bone when we can pull it apart into different bones. So he started studying these micro motions. And what he found is that they had a pattern that happened of movement that actually reflects how our cerebral spinal fluid moves in our brain. So one thing that osteopaths have known for a long time is that the lymphatic system in the brain is drained by the motion of the cerebral spinal fluid. So we came up with a whole modality in order to treat that called cranial osteopathy. And one of the cranial trained osteopaths wanted this to be more approachable, more available to the general public. So he trained PTs, massage therapists, OTs on craniosacral therapy, which is basically a protocol that anyone with hands-on palpatory skills can do with the effect of resetting the system. But there's more to cranial osteopathy than just craniosacral. So as a cranial osteopath, I can actually diagnose dysfunctions in the brain and the skull, in the fluids, and then I have treatment modalities that I can use for it. And one of the things that we see from this for the autistic community is that there are usually patterns of disruption in the fluids in the skull that really contribute to the symptoms. We know that if fluid sits around anywhere in the body, we get lymphatic congestion. We don't get neurons that work as well. And when we can treat that with a hands-on approach, we see a lot better improvement in how someone is able to function, right? It's not a full treatment. I subscribe to the idea that we are genetically different, but we can optimize our genetic functioning in a ton of different ways through things like cranial osteopathy and functional medicine.
Wow. Wow. Sounds fascinating. It also sounds like something that I don't hear of often. Like you said, it's not so out there for the public. So I'm happy that you're like here today explaining it to us, because it's really like, even when I learned about it, I went to extra training for the craniosacral. Yep. And honestly, if I have to be honest, I don't know that I necessarily felt comfortable doing it. So someone like you, who actually really studied it and understood it and don't just understand the hands-on approach of it, probably are going to get much further. What kind of things, functional things, are you seeing in children that your work could then help a child with?
Yeah, so I do a lot of newborn care. I do a lot of kind of full spectrum care, but really I see a ton of moms and newborns in my practice. And what I find is that from birth, we get compressions in the body just from coming through the birth canal, right? Unless we treat those with hands-on care, as we grow, those compressions are going to grow into our body. And one of the things that can help optimize our function overall is to get that treated out. And we look at things like the fascia, we look at the bones. We know that babies are born with a ton more kind of areas that can get compressed, right? Our tailbone, our sacrum, is actually in 5 pieces when we're born. There are bones in our skull that are also in pieces, like our occipital bone, and we can get dysfunction in and around the brainstem that is persistent. So especially in our nonverbal kids, we tend to find restrictions in the base of the skull that improve with treatment. And we see improvement in how the cranial nerves function. For our older kids that have ADHD, if we're not getting clearance, right? If we're not getting clearance of that, we see more irritability. We see more issues with impulse control because the fluids aren't circulating in the parts of the brain where they should be. So we can see a whole spectrum of consequences that we can see as behaviors that are actually driven from some of these things that happen in the skull.
Wow. Okay, give us like a practical story of like a scenario, one or two, that come into your office and with X issue, and then what do they look like afterwards that they feel like it was worthwhile to see an osteopath?
Yeah, so one of the things that I see a lot is kids that are hyperactive, right? So one of the things we know about ADHD is that our executive function is lacking, right? Executive function develops at a slower rate and isn't fully developed until we're older in the neurodivergent community. if we can focus on getting blood flow return to areas of the brain like the frontal lobe, what we end up seeing is that they end up catching up to their peers in their executive functioning. So one of the things with impulse control is that we tend to see decreased fluid motion in the front part of the brain. And when that gets treated out, everything we do to help their behaviors then becomes easier. They respond to the therapies that we do. They respond better and have better emotional regulation after they've had treatment. And it makes family life and family dynamics that much easier when we can have improved outcomes because we've treated something that is an at-risk area of a neurodivergent brain, and we've got it functioning optimally for what it can do, right? I'm never saying that we're going to absolutely cure a neurologic difference, but we can help someone function to the best of their ability. Same thing with adults. I see a ton of adults that come in, especially postpartum moms, with that mommy brain, that dysfunction, you know, I'm just not keeping up, maybe undiagnosed ADHD. And now we have all of these demands of caring for a newborn, that all of that executive dysfunction comes out. So we can optimize that with hands-on care.
Wow, amazing. Tell us a little bit about what treatment looks like. So they come in and you're going to evaluate them. How do you evaluate them? And then, like, what might treatment look like?
Yeah, so usually I do a full kind of screening evaluation. I do a lot of nutrition counseling. I do a lot of kind of full spectrum integrative care. So someone's filled out a huge questionnaire for me. I review that. We talk about what their goals are. And then we go to a physical exam. So we do an in-depth exam to look for signs of nutritional deficiencies, to look for mechanical issues. We screen out someone in a standing position, watch them walk, then have them sit down, look at the spine, have them lay down, look at the head, look at the neck, look at all parts of the body to see what is restricted and what we can optimize for them by the time they leave the office.
So it's like within one visit that you're already able to make some sort of recommendation to a parent as far as how they might better whatever issue it is they're dealing with.
Yeah, we do, you know, in osteopathic medicine, we call it a screening exam. So we basically look for areas of the body that aren't moving the way they should. And how can we optimize that with hands-on care? And then how can we add to it with nutrition, lifestyle changes, diet, exercise, which is huge for neurodivergent people because it increases blood flow to the brain. And we give a full kind of multi-system point recommendation. And then it's anything like we do in science, right? We make some changes. We see what got better, what still needs help. And then we reevaluate and do it again.
Love that. Love that. Tell us a little bit about the nutrition piece. What main issues are you seeing today in children with ADHD, autism, as far as intake goes, and then, you know, what they should be eating, and then maybe some solutions to how to fix those issues?
Yeah, so I say across the board, not just people with ADHD, but almost everyone in America is really carb heavy in what they eat. We're seeing a ton of people that are having, you know, more than 20% of their daily calories come from refined sugars. And
20% sounds like a low number to me if I think about like what our American diet looks like.
Right. But we know when we hit 20% refined sugar intake, micronutrient deficiencies start going up exponentially. So even by 25% sugar intake, if we can cut 5%, it decreases the amount of micronutrients that are deficient in the body because we're getting more nutrients in from foods that actually have nutritional value. And we're not causing harm to the body with the sugars, and the sugars need antioxidants to be processed. And we use those up really quickly, especially if we don't have them coming in from the diet. So I start with looking at what they're doing. We up protein intake because that's usually lacking. And then we look at how we can optimize the foods, you know, taking out processed foods, getting more vegetables than fruits in the diet, and getting fresh foods in when we can that are in season, locally grown, and organic if possible.
Okay. I know this is a silly question. What are you referring to when you say micronutrients?
Micronutrients, so vitamins and minerals.
Okay, so what you're saying, just tell me if I understood correct, is that if we're having a lot of the processed white or beigey foods, then we're sort of replacing that with the other kind of foods, which are much heavier in the positive nutrients that we're looking for.
Right. So we pull those out of the diet when we can. We have to replace them with something. And if we replace them with anything that's colorful, right? We think about the colors of the rainbow and getting one color in of the rainbow every day. And that starts us off with either 8 fruits or vegetables. That's a ton more than most people tend to get in their day. So if we can make it fun for the kids, right? Sometimes we'll have color themed nights here in our household. So we'll let our kid pick, you know, do you want green, red, blue, right? Purple. We can do purple potatoes and make some like fresh potato gnocchi out of purple sweet potatoes and just make good homemade foods that are fun then to eat, because it's choice and option and novelty, all of things which the ADHD brain craves, and a way to do it that looks pretty on the plate.
Yeah. And if you make it at home with the child, then you also have all that good engagement going on.
Yes.
Wow. I like purple day. Go ahead. Give us a blue day. Let's hear what you do for blue.
So we do, you know, blueberries. We do blue spirulina powder, right? I'll put that in like a paleo pancake mix, and we'll add some protein powder in to get protein in on top of the almond flour. Low refined sugars, blue spirulina, make blue pancakes with a blue blueberry compote on top. That's one of our kids' favorite blue dinners.
I love that. You're so creative. Okay, what do you do for green? Green, I think, is going to be easier.
Green is easy, right? I mean, you can add green anything, right? We can blend spinach and put spinach powders in anything. We can make, fresh fruits, veggies, green drinks. Green is easy. It's getting especially
how about
blue
red
and purple
without,
are the hard ones.
Yeah, blue and purple are hard. Red is pretty easy too, because you have the tomatoes. What else do you do in the reds?
Yeah, you've got berries, you've got tomatoes, you know, you can do red peppers, you can do sun-dried tomato, you can do a lot of things to make red.
Oh, I love this. I'm gonna try this in my house. So much fun. And orange is also easy. You have the oranges and you have the carrots. What else do you like to put in your orange day?
Orange bell peppers, you can do, you know,
all kinds of fun stuff.
You can do lots of different things. So I'm blanking on the name. It's an Italian fruit that is like a persimmon.
Oh,
there we go.
Yeah, there you
persimmons
go.
Make an excellent orange. Getting any type of orange vegetable in really helps.
And I like that you're bringing innovation to it and making it exciting for the kids, because
Yeah,
and if we as adults make it exciting and we're like ramped up about it and come up with the cute themes. I've never heard this theme before. You're the first person that ever brought this up. The days of the week being different colors. I love it. I'm going to go with that. But if we're innovative and we're excited about the different kinds of foods and tasting the different kinds of foods, then it's contagious and the kids feel that excitement as well and we'll jump right on board.
And especially, you know, 3, 4, they can mash up eggs. They can do a whole bunch of different things for you to help prep the food, and it makes it a fun family event. So our household also is all celiac. My husband and I met in med school because we both had celiac disease.
Oh, wow.
And we were in the middle of Tennessee where there was nothing gluten-free 15 years ago, right? So we have always been primarily home-based for most of our meals because it's hard to find safe things out to eat. So our kids, part of their homeschool is that they make breakfast and lunch for themselves, right? So our 7-year-old is in charge. Our, you know, 19-month-old likes to crack the eggs already, mix up the eggs, whisk, right? All of these things we can teach our kids to do, and then they know how to do it as a lifelong skill.
Wow, that's amazing. And that's great that you're getting them to participate in the kitchen, because there's so much great development that goes on when we do cooking with our children. Just the instructions and like the physical movement and the trial and error that's going on there. So that's really awesome. Okay, so So pretty much we were just, let's just finish with nutrition before I jump on to the next topic. So pretty much a lot of your counseling is about what the intake is in nutrition and then recommending good, healthy diet, trying to go for more fruits and vegetables, less processed items.
Yeah.
Are there other recommendations that you make in the area of nutrition, supplements, anything like that?
It depends on what I see on the evaluation, right? If we're dealing with picky and restrictive eating, which is a common thing to be dealing with, we'll brainstorm together different ways to sneak those nutrients into the plate, right? We don't have to have boxed mac and cheese as the orange coloring, right? We can make a blended mac and cheese at home that we put veggies in and we try to cover up the taste of it to make that sauce and put it over a lentil pasta or put it over black bean pasta. It's one of my kids' favorite things to swap out. They love black bean pasta, and you wouldn't think that that'd be a kid favorite, but I haven't had a kid yet who doesn't like homemade pasta sauce on black bean pasta.
Wow. Okay. I love it. Great ideas. Okay. Now, another area that you mentioned that you do in your evaluation is movement. Like, are you looking at children that have a different, like an interesting gait pattern? Like the way they walk is interesting. Is it blockage, like something that's bothering them? Like, why might somebody come in for a movement-based issue?
Yeah, so if we're looking at movement, one of the things I do is have someone walk up and down the hallway. And for kids, you can get a lot of information about how they're processing the world, right? Are they toe walking? Do they have retained primitive reflexes that we need to treat? Do they have an issue with gait and balance because their eyes aren't level? So we know that for our proprioception, right, how we interact with the world, our body's goal is always to keep those eyes level with the ground we're walking on. That's why 50% of our proprioceptors are in the top three vertebrae in our neck. So we want to look and see, are they skewed at baseline and are they having issues with that upper neck? Or are they having leg length discrepancies that are just not being diagnosed? And that's contributing to why they're toe walking on one side or the other. So we do a full kind of evaluation to look and see what's going on. And then we test primitive reflexes because we know retained primitive reflexes can lead to issues that look like autism or ADHD.
Yeah. Are you comfortable delving in a little bit to explain to us what exactly primitive reflexes are and how they might, like, if we have a retained primitive reflex, what it might look like? Like, I know the gallant is a big one that looks like ADHD, right?
Yep.
So let's just start with the premise of just explaining what retained reflexes are.
Yeah. So when we are born with these reflexes that help keep us safe in the world. So a baby, the big one that we see is a Moro, right? A fencer reflex. When they're startled, they put their arms out, they put the legs out so that if they fall, they're falling onto a limb instead of directly on their head. Their head is the heaviest part of their body. It's going to fall the fastest and hit the ground first. So everything is designed around protection of our head. So we have all of these different reflexes in place, like rooting, like suckling, that help the baby be nourished and well. We lose those reflexes as we age, or at least we're supposed to. So sometimes if we keep those reflexes in our body, we then get these patterns of behavior. We get these patterns that are predictable that we can then assess and see if that could be the cause of why someone is having behavioral issues or why someone is having issues with toe walking or pigeon walking. And there's a whole slew of these primitive reflexes that we should lose. There are great online videos that you can just Google primitive reflexes. And there are OTs, PTs, chiros, DOs who have walked through this and have free YouTube resources where they're pretty easy things like scraping the skin in certain places, doing a tap on the forehead, like I have a retained glabellar reflex. I don't know if this is video or not, but if I tap my own forehead, you're supposed to be able to stop blinking. I cannot stop blinking. And it's one of the things that we could try to, yep, you can stop. I can't.
It's funny because I'm trained in reflex integration. The only reason I asked for a long explanation is because it's something that a lot of us don't understand. So I figured if we're talking about it, we better explain it. But that one I've never heard of. So that's why when you said it, I'm trying it because I'm like, hey, I've never heard that reflex
before. Yeah, so that's a glabellar reflex. So people who have retained what's called metopic suture, a suture in the middle of the frontal bone, tend to have it. We don't know why that's correlation, but for me, I have never been able to treat that out of myself, and I live with another cranial osteopath. So it's a really easy one for me to demonstrate anywhere. It's just you're supposed to be able to stop blinking. I cannot do it. So med students get a kick out of it, and I get tapped in the forehead a lot. So
okay. I'm sure one day you'll figure out how to open up that pathway. What is the reflex integration for it? What are you, how are you supposed to integrate it?
So I've tried doing the reflex integration. I've tried doing cranial. I've tried doing a lot of things that one is just stuck there for me. My husband's even tried hypnotizing it out a time or two just out of curiosity. And I don't know if it's just my eyes. I can't get anything close to my eye without blinking.
Oh, wow. Oh, wow. And that could, like, if you back it up, like, the blinking could be also, like, a protection of the eyes, and that's why we originally had it. So it is very cool to look at the different reflexes and see why we, you know, the fight or flight, and like you said, the morrow. Like, we have a lot of good ones that we could really understand why a baby or, you know, a young child would need it, and in utero they might need it, and then, you know, how then it gets integrated. Do you work with the gallant a lot?
I work with it some.
Some, okay.
I basically screen in the office and I go through. And even I still sometimes have to look up what the integration process is for that particular one. For me, the diagnosis is always the most important because if I don't know about it, I can't test for it. But there's a whole, you know, manual of how to integrate all of the reflexes. And I just open it up and go to the page and say, all right, we're going to do this. And it's something that even you can do at home if you look up the exercises. So sometimes I'll just assign it as a task for families to do at home if I don't have time to do it in the office.
Another huge one that I see in my office is a lot of morrow with anxiety. And there's also online a lot of great, like, starfish and different integrative stuff online for the morrow as well.
Yeah. And, you know, vagus nerve exercises, vagus nerve stretching, nerve flossing. There's a ton of different ways to try to treat the different issues. But for me, it's getting someone who knows how to do all of those tests and then someone literally just sitting down and doing it. I can't tell you the number of times, even doing family medicine, where people come in and say, oh, my doctor has never touched me, has never done like a physical exam on me. And it makes me sad.
Why is it so important for a doctor to do a physical exam?
A story is only half of the information, right? Maybe even less. It gives you an idea of where you're going, but without a good physical examination, you don't know to look out for any of the other things, right? Our differential is huge on any given issue. And without that physical exam information, especially things like, you know, back pain, leg pain, it's huge to be able to do all of the reflexes and all of the other neurologic examination to make sure that we're both ruling out the bad things and looking for causes that are actually treatable.
Wow. Wow. I love it. Yeah. And like you were saying, if you're looking at like a scientific side of things, like we can't just have reports. So we have to really see it in real time because it is, we all have our biases and we all have our, you know, whatever it is that really bothers us and somehow seems to come to the front. But sometimes it's nice to get it like completely observed by an outside source like a doctor who's able to like take a fresh page and see the person for that person today and not for their past histories.
Yeah.
Amazing. Excellent. Now you brought up toe walking, which I know is huge in the community. And, I've heard different reasons why we toe walk, and in therapy, obviously, we address it from like a sensory perspective, a lot of times a balanced perspective. But would you be able to delve into it for a minute or two and tell us a little bit about the reasons why someone might toe walk and what are things that they might want to try to help bring them down? Or is it something that you think is okay?
Yeah. So one of the things that one of my mentors has always said is that the muscle is only ever doing what the nerve tells it to do. So it is a symptom of something going on in the nervous system. Now, what is that? Is that truly, right, anatomic? Is it really a shortened Achilles tendon? And that's painful for them to walk. Is it just that we have hypertonicity or increased muscle tone in the lower leg because we are having something going on in the nerve that's in the leg? Is it somewhere in the spinal cord or is it up in the brain? And it's really looking at all of those tests to figure out where this person's cause is coming from, because we're seeing it as one symptom, but that symptom can have 50 different causes. So we can't just say toe walking relates to one particular thing. So it needs a full evaluation and examination to see why it's going on for someone. And, you know, being an osteopath, osteopathic manipulation is a big component of what I do to address it. Even if they're going to PT, OT, if we're doing bracing, if we're doing other things to retrain the nervous system, treating the nervous system itself is still important.
Wow. Okay. So pretty much we can't give a diagnosis for any specific person, but root causes, like you first mentioned, was like sometimes pain, what the nerves are telling us. Do you see it related to vision or balance?
Sometimes, especially the kids who aren't quite level, we're seeing it related. We're also seeing it related to kids who have poor eyesight because they're leaning forward to get a better view of the world, because 6 inches makes a big difference if that's where their focal length is when they're constantly leaning forward.
Wow. And how about the sensory component? Do you ever see that it's sensory?
Sometimes, right? Sometimes. Maybe it's just my own bias, but I think most autistic people have had experience with the sock texture and socks and shoes being a big sensory thing that we need to overcome in order to go out into the community. So even if they will walk normally in a particular sandal or a slipper, that's an accommodation that's acceptable because we want the pattern to be set with them walking normally.
Wow. And many a times what I've seen is as an occupational therapist is that real sensory seekers, those that are really looking for extra input, if I put all the weight of my body on my toes, then I get extra feeling into my toes. So it could sometimes be sensory avoidant because we don't like the texture. And sometimes it could be sensory seeking because yes, I'm looking for that extra information to my toes. And when I put all the weight of my body on that toe, then I really know where my toe is in space and I feel that satiation of sensory input.
Yeah.
Okay, we touched on vision for a moment. Do you evaluate for it?
I do.
You do. You want to just explain a little bit about what you're looking for in your evaluation and what sort of issues clients might have and, you know, what sort of remedies there might be for it?
Yeah, so similarly like we do for concussion management, I think eye tracking is a great thing to look at for the autistic community. If our eyes are not focusing, right, if we are not having the right focal length, meaning how our eyes are coming together to look at a certain point to keep it in focus, if we can't bring the eyes together, or what's called convergence, and if we can't keep tracking, or if we have something called binocular vision disorder, where we get a little bit of a skew of one of the eyes, all of these things are common in neurodivergence. It may be sensory input, too much sensory input, the brain's trying to figure out a way to lessen that. We don't really know why yet, but vision is huge. And anything that we can do to accommodate being able to see our world, our body is going to do, and our body is going to find all these weird things to be able to make it the best for us. So if we look at how the eyes are tracking, if we can do right, smooth pursuits and saccades, they're called, where we look at how the eye tracks around as an object moves, or how the eyes track a still object when our head moves, we can get a ton of information about how the brain is then processing that. So we look at it. I used to do a full kind of neurovestibular. I don't have enough clients that need it anymore to actually have the computer program to do it anymore. But that's one thing. If I'm screening and I find something that looks abnormal, I'm sending them out for a full evaluation. And, you know, there's a ton of sports med facilities now that will do the testing because we're tracking concussions so well. So it's easy to get the testing now, I think, than it was 10 years ago.
Yeah, I happen to think that vision plays such a huge role in our lives in general. Like, I get children, you know, that come in for like a fine motor issue and it's really mostly vision, or, you know, like a balance issue and it's a lot of vision. So I feel like that's one of the fields that a lot of people miss, you know, how important our eyes are and what their function is. What kind of treatment is out there for an individual who does identify issues with, let's say, tracking or saccadic eye movements?
Yeah, so there
convergence, divergence. Yeah,
yeah, there are a ton of computer-based programs now that are for retraining, mostly developed post concussion. Alternatively, can be used in the autistic community really well. The other option, especially with binocular vision disorder, is we can put a small prism in a lens that kind of forces the eye back to the midline if we're getting kind of that lazy looking eye all the time, that will correct it. But you need to find a neuro-ophthalmologist who's trained in doing that, which is sometimes the tricky thing.
Yeah, and my experience with it is that you have to get a really good neurodevelopmental ophthalmologist to do it, optometrist, and then not always does it work on the first try. So they give the lenses, and if it doesn't work, people give up pretty fast because they're hard to get appointments by. But it is, when it works right, it's beautiful.
Also harder to find. There are some of us that are trained with osteopathy in something called osteopathic vision diagnosis. Dr. Charlie Beck out of Indianapolis is one of the trainers for it. But actually feeling how the brain itself changes and how the rhythms of the head change while we're putting on different lenses is one of the ways that we fit a prescription to the cranial rhythm, which sometimes is not the exact diagnosis of the eye. So people who are having persistent either headaches or persistent issues after we change a prescription, sometimes I will pull out my eyeglass kit and I will change their prescription up just slightly, and then all of a sudden their headaches go away. So it's another thing to look for. There aren't nearly as many of us who are trained in it, but if you are lucky enough to find one of us, it's one of the best things that I have found that actually got rid of my migraine headaches, because I was able to actually have my prescription done in a way that it supports the health of my body. We think about the cranial rhythmic impulse, the movement of the cerebrospinal fluid, as the primary driver of why the cranial bones move. And if the length that our eye needs to change in order to accommodate the wrong prescription is off, we'll actually feel it in the body. And people who are able to feel that end up being the ones that, you know, keep coming back, that you're like, you know, why, we just changed your prescription the tiniest bit. Oh, I don't like the way it feels. Try to find a cranial vision osteopath. Osteopathicvision.com is his website, and you can see who of us are trained to do it.
That's fascinating. I'm so happy I got to speak to you today and learn this, because I have so many clients that really struggle with the vision piece. And I'm actually trained in the Dr. Letterman from Israel's program, which is a lot of like saccadic eye movements, convergence, divergence, and pursuits. And we do a lot of like on the trampoline reading and like movement and vision exercises. But like you're saying, if there are other ways to fix it, it's very long-term to go through like the vision therapy route. And, you know, a lot of these children are struggling with more than one thing at a time. So to be in so many therapies at a time, it's kind of like a trade-off of what's, you know, what to do first and what to do second.
And third, you know, and fourth. What's available and what do you have time for? What's going to be supported by your IEP and all of the things that come into life on the spectrum, right?
Yeah. Okay. Now, the next topic you touched on was exercise. I would love to just hear a little bit more about your thoughts on exercise and how we can, you know, chicken before the egg, egg before the chicken. Why are children, you know, if they don't exercise, then they don't have the stamina, but why is it because there's things going on and that's why they're not exercising? Or are they, because they don't exercise, they don't continue? Tell us a little bit about what you're seeing in the exercise arena for children, neurodiverse children.
Yeah. So again, if we look at neurodivergence as sensory seeking or sensory avoidant issues, exercise is a big stimulus. So a lot of kids love to run, love to move around. Those are our hyperactive kids that are easy to find. On the other end, if your eyes are not tracking well, if you're having headaches, if you get upset stomach from running and doing exercise, it's going to be something that goes into that avoidance category. So my goal is always to find something that will move the body that is acceptable to that individual person. So is that rebounder for those really vestibular kids? Is that sitting and pedaling a bike for kids who don't want their head to move around? Is it running outside? Is it playing a sport? Is it doing things like swim or, you know, gymnastics or Ninja Warrior classes? Whatever is going to move the body, because we know long-term health, the more we move, the better we can get. And there was a study that was done on looking at 30 minutes of aerobic activity. So at least moderate level aerobic activity, meaning your heart rate's going up about 60 to 70% of your maximum capacity. Kids that moved their body 30 minutes a day saw the same benefits in the frontal lobe blood flow as stimulant medications. So Are we able to do something that's going to affect someone just as much as a stimulant medication, which can be a life-saving medication? But if I have a natural alternative to a medication that someone's going to be prescribed for the rest of their life, I always want to incorporate that. And exercise, we know long-term cardiac health is better, weight management is easier, metabolism stays better. So we're always looking to find what is the acceptable thing that we can get someone to do and just do it.
That's amazing. And I like that you're putting it at 30 minutes because so I have children of my own and I'm always like, as soon as they come home from school, I'm like, out the door, everybody out the door. We're playing basketball. We're playing football. And I'm like, just stay out for as long as possible, because then when it gets dark, you know, depending on which time of the year it is. Okay. Summer, we have a little bit more time to be out there, but winter, like an hour later, it's dark and I'm always like, okay, did they get their energy out? Was it enough time out there? So 30 minutes is a very achievable goal. Yep. And I like that idea of anything that the child will be agreeable to. And I do think as parents, it's our little bit of a duty of ours to really help children learn to exercise and learn to move. And if they're not feeling motivated to go to someone to help them learn to move, because being, you know, sedentary, I'm sure you could explain to us exactly where you see the blockage when that happens, but it's, there's a lot of blockage.
There is. And long-term, if we look at our health, we know that just 30 minutes of exercise 5 days a week can set us up for long-term health. It changes, one, it increases blood flow, so we get better blood flow to our brain. It produces serotonin, so we get happy. We get good lymphatic movement throughout our whole body. So we have decreased incidence of autoimmune disease in people who exercise. We have decreased incidence of dementia in people who exercise because we got the lymph flowing. And we see all of these things that it doesn't sound hard to do 30 minutes, 5 days a week, but when we overfill our plates and we have a million things to do, sometimes it gets hard to get those 30 minutes in. So that's my starting point is, hey, we all need to do 30 minutes, right? If you're doing it as a parent, your kid is more likely going to follow you because you're leading by example. You're not saying you have to do this thing that I'm not willing to do. It's good for everyone. So even a family activity, a family walk outside, going over to the park, anything that's going to be an incentive for your kid to move is where we start.
Love it. I love it. And I feel like it's extra motivating to me and to everyone listening that, like, really we need to incorporate it into our schedule. And when we do, we'll see the positive mental health benefits as well. Every time I commit to doing my 30-minute walk, and I actually carry through with it, and consistently, I always say, like, it clears my head, you know, like it's yep. you think it's a physical thing, but you're telling us the science behind it, but it definitely gets the brain flowing and it feels good and it has long-term effects. And then we're able to be better parents too, because if yes. we're feeling good, then we,
and when we're more regulated, our kids are more regulated, right? There's
100%.
There's a theory in Taoist or Chinese medicine, traditional Chinese medicine, that the energy body of a child is not separated or doesn't start to separate from their mother until they're 7 years old. So literally, traditional Chinese medicine will say your child that's less than seven is an extension of your nervous system. So if you're stressed, if you're not regulated, we can't expect young kids to actually regulate without us being the thing that's going to regulate them.
And what's so cool, you have a 7-year-old and a 18-month-old, so you're in the stage right now, is that you really hear them, like, so genuinely making comments about your regulation state, mom's regulation state, dad's regulation state. And the way you're explaining it is, it's very intuitive to them. It's an extension of you. They're an extension of you. So it's really cool. Like, sometimes I hear my 5-year-old narrating, like, how I'm feeling. Mommy, you have an upset look on your face. You must be feeling very badly. And I'm thinking, like, you're so young. How do you get that? And there you go. They're an extension. They feel it.
They feel it. They feel it in their body, right? That's one of the papers, right, that just came out. A lot of the nonverbal kids didn't think that mind-to-mind communication, they were hearing your thoughts. They didn't think they had to speak out loud, right?
Wow. Wow. Yeah, and I guess another nice thing for us as parents to turn it into is that because they are feeling our emotions, if we do have negative emotions or, you know, even positive emotions, but narrating it and showing them a solution to it instead of escalating it and modeling that, like, yeah, mommy is sad right now. I'm feeling a little bit upset because X, Y, and Z. But in order to make myself better and feel better about the situation, you know, and if you walk them through those steps, we give them a chance at being greater adults who understand themselves and are able to self-regulate.
Yeah. So one of my husband's theories as a hypnotist is that a lot of the things that happen in neurotypical subconscious happen in the actual consciousness of autistic people. So whereas someone who's neurotypical can wake up in the morning and their checklist of things to do of their morning routine just happens on autopilot for them, autistic individuals will go through that like the process is being spoken out loud to them, right? First, I have to wash my hands. Then I need to wash my face. Now I need to get my toothbrush out and put the toothpaste on. That doesn't happen in a neurotypical brain. So if we can walk them through and give them an algorithm and a process that their brain can then pick up and say, oh, this is how this happens, it's more likely that they're going to pick that up long term. So anytime we can narrate out loud what our internal thought processes are, we can gift that to our kids as something that they'll be able to do for themselves in the future.
Very powerful. Okay, so we're like winding down, but I still have so much things that I want to still discuss with you. Okay, so tell us a little bit about, you know, you spoke about you having some sort of neurodivergence, your husband a little bit neurodivergent. Tell us a little bit about what symptoms you've struggled with, maybe socially what you've – tell us a little bit about what struggles you had or didn't have, and if you want to talk a little bit about your husband as well, and then what pulled you through that? Like, what was your journey? And you are so successful and you are so intelligent. I am enjoying every moment of this conversation. So I think you're like a real inspiration to the neurodivergent world. Tell us a little bit about your journey and what, how you got to where you are today.
Yeah. So I think like a lot of us was born into a family that is, now that I am aware, clearly neurodivergent. My dad is ADHD to the extreme, always lost his keys, wallet, phone, never had any idea where they were when we were growing up. My mom ran corporations, but if you asked her to do simple tasks at home, it was a meltdown. So growing up in that situation, I was the really quiet kid. I was the quiet kid that studied all the time because books made sense to me, written things were enjoyable. I played sports. I played softball. I ended up going to college on a sports scholarship to pitch for a D3 team. So I threw all of my passions and my hyper-focus into kind of those two realms. And at the same time, when I came home from school, when I was done with a tournament on the weekend, I would collapse. I would need a day or two just doing absolutely nothing in order to recover from that. And I thought that was normal. So fast forward to college through to med school. When I was in medical school, I really wasn't feeling well. I had normalized a lot of my celiac symptoms. So I thought it was normal to have 8 to 10 bowel movements a day. I thought it was normal to have brain fog. I thought it was normal for me to feel anxious all the time. And being diagnosed with celiac and going through my own experience of, hey, you have to eat gluten-free. All right, I'm eating gluten-free. It got rid of 50% of my symptoms. But I notice now when I eat cheese or when I have too much carb, I get the exact same symptoms. Why is that? Well, people would say, you know, it's not a big deal. It's no issue. We don't know why that's happening, except if we look at the functional medicine realm, oh, you can have other food triggers. And that's where I really started diving into functional medicine and study. And I had gone through and basically learned throughout my life to put in these breaks and these pauses for recovery, because as a med student, I don't know how familiar people are with medical school training, but you're expected to be 60 to 80 hours a week in the hospital learning. So I would do absolutely nothing but study. Anything that was a social demand that was outside of that was really, really hard for me to do because I just didn't have the energy. I had used up all of my spoons, my masking power, in order to learn to be a doctor, that I got to the point where any social situation, I would just say no to because I knew it was going to be too much for me. So when I met my husband in medical school, we were very similar in that, meaning that it was okay for us to come home and essentially body double on the couch. And we each would either read our book or we would study on our own, and we would just have companionship in something that we could recover together. And it wasn't until we had our first son and we were both last year in our medical residency that we didn't have that recovery time, where he became almost suicidal in residency and had to take time off. Where, you know, I was voted in as our chief resident and I had so much on my plate that I felt like I wasn't there for my kids. And once we graduated from that environment and we had more time again, we started noticing things with our son that were very similar to how we grew up, meaning he would be absolutely fine at daycare and he would come home and melt down. He would have sensory issues with his clothes. We couldn't wash his hair. We couldn't, you know, get him to eat certain foods. And that's what led to both of us being diagnosed as ADHD, so autism and ADHD. And both of us kind of learning how we can repattern our own behaviors, how we can set up our lives for success so that we can still be present for our kids, that we can still do the things that we're passionate about, you know, the things that we've studied. I don't know if you can see the book wall behind me here, but, you know, it goes across our whole office. We probably have 5,000 books because that's what we love to do. So between osteopathy and traditional Chinese medicine and acupuncture and functional medicine and nutrition, all of these things became passions of mine that is part of who I am just as a neurodivergent person. But also I think make me a better clinician because I'm willing to look at what's outside of what's being taught at medical school right now. I'm willing to look at what energy feels like for people and what our lived experiences are that are different from what are reported and honestly aren't the things that are put in the DSM-5 as abnormal when they're really just normal for 20 to 30% of the population, right?
And that is true, exactly. And it's amazing how you bring that view and you're able to really like apply it into practice and help so many people with all of that knowledge, research, and interest, the fact that you're motivated to learn it and apply it because you lived it.
Yes.
Wow. Wow. Well, Lauren, I thank you so much for coming on today. Yes. You are so amazing. I could keep talking for hours with you because you have so much interesting things to share with us. Thank you for coming on. Thank you for sharing. And you should have continued success in your journey. If you had to leave off with one message for parents or caregivers of neurodivergent children, what would that message be?
That your kid is perfect the way they are, right? We can do everything that we can do to support them in who they are meant to be. And who they are meant to be is perfect.
I love that. I love that. Thank you so much for everything. And I hope we get you back on again because I want to hear next your parenting view and all of that. I wouldn't get to delve into your children yet, but okay, maybe on another episode.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Lauren. Have a wonderful, wonderful day.